Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Monash. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from Oak Brook, Illinois. Welcome to the show, my good friend, Michael Flight.
Thank you very much, Victor. It's always an honor to be with the man that wrote the book on magnetic capital.
Oh, gee whiz, you're too kind. Well, great to have you here, Michael. It's been a while since you've been on the show, and you specialize in retail commercial shopping centers. It's an area that's gone through a lot of transition over the last couple of years. But before we dive into the details, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Sure. I originally started in commercial real estate in 1986 and decided to go into retail real estate because you could do multiple deals with one tenant versus in office or industrial or even sales. It's one and then you got to go out cold calling again. So it was either efficiency or laziness, but I chose retail real estate for the repeat business. Worked for a large syndicator through the end of the 80s. They had about 270 shopping centers. After the tax laws changes in mid-1980s, their business model went away. Plus, there was a bunch of distress in with the savings and loans. So we started our own company in 1990, done a lot of institutional real estate where our joint venture partners were major insurance companies. Up to recently, I met you through the real estate guys because we decided to change our model and work with retail investors and diversify our investor base. So that brought me into this whole world of podcasts and things that I had no idea was even out there. So it was a great transition. Most recently, I've been not only doing the retail real estate and single tenant triple net properties, but also doing syndications where the shares are issued to a blockchain. That's an old dog learning new tricks.
There you go. Well, certainly lots to talk about in all of that. Now, much has been written about the retail apocalypse, and the pandemic certainly frightened a lot of people in the world of retail when you literally couldn't leave your house. But still, retail is changing. We're seeing some retailers shift to smaller footprints. We're seeing consolidation. We are seeing some of the older properties in some markets struggling. And then, of course, we've seen interest rates going up. What's your take on the landscape today? What keeps you up at night? What are you seeing?
Well, since 2017, I've been telling everybody that would listen that retail has constantly evolved, and it's evolved from the Sears catalog and the Montgomery Ward's catalog. They were the Amazons of their day, to department stores, to, you know, downtown street retail, to major malls. And then it really started in the 1980s, evolving into strip centers. And those are the open centers that you could walk into. And then right around that time, Walmart took off, and Walmart is still, you know, the largest retailer in the world. And they're really almost not a retailer. They're really almost just a distributor. They, you know exactly what stuff to put in for any demographic that they're in. And I think the stat is that there's a Walmart within a 25-mile drive of just about 95% of the country, you know, and we're talking about the United States. Mm-hmm. So retail has constantly been evolving. We decided that around 2017 that there were certain tenants that were going to be really impacted by online retail. And there were going to be other tenants that people by necessity like to go to every day. So your grocery stores, your automotive services, your dentist, your doctor, medical, all that stuff is not going to go online. And then there's experiential. Restaurants are definitely not going to go online. And, you know, as people found out, that it's not fun just living in your house for 2 years straight. So you want to go out and have an experience. And I was just talking to somebody today. We've got a really great shopping center in the Chicago area, and we put a local grocery tenant in there, and it's a local chain, and they were just had a big cash infusion from one of the large private equity groups. They were all worried because Amazon was opening up right across the street, And this retailer is doing, out of 70,000 square feet, probably like $55 million a year in volume. Our biggest problem with the shopping center is there's no parking available because everybody is just doing top sales. Amazon opened up one of their new creepy stores where it follows you around with cameras and stuff throughout the entire store. The Amazon parking lot is constantly empty. So there is a big thing to knowing your clientele, merchandising towards the local, and you'll just fill up your store if you know who you're merchandising to. And that's, you know, really been the trick of, you know, all great tenants. So sorry to make such a long, you know, explanation, but.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Now, even within properties that are performing well today, one of the things that's on the minds of a lot of people is just the rising interest rate environment. Whether these shopping malls have been funded in the bond market, with conventional banks and CMBS loans, whatever it might be, as these debt instruments roll over, there's going to be a rate adjustment. What's going to happen to those properties? Will they be able to withstand the change in debt service when those documents roll over?
It really depends. I've got some friends that work in the CMBS ratings, and in 2020, the biggest issue was all the hotels. And so the CMBS bonds that had a lot of hotels in them, they were all just tanking. And right now, the biggest stress in the CMBS market is for office buildings, because people have gotten used to work from home. And even I was talking to somebody that regularly works down in the city of Chicago, and they can't get, they're actually, one of the office buildings is paying a restaurant to stay open because they can't get those amenities because, you know, with a 3-day work week, the restaurants don't have enough people to support like a Subway sandwich or something. So that's, you know, an area of distress. The other area of distress, particularly in retail, is we have to define malls are enclosed malls. And so there's really good malls, which they call fortress malls, like right where I am at Oak Brook, you know, just probably like a half a mile away is Oak Brook Shopping Center. And that literally is a generational fortress mall that pulls people in from, you know, a few different states. It's a really good mall. And then there's the B and C malls, which, you know, might have a JCPenney's and they might have a Kohl's. And you could tell they're a really bad shopping center, that if they've got like a Round One or some golf place in, where there used to be a department store. We were in late 1990s, early 2000s, some of the pioneers in what was called demalling. So we redeveloped three malls, and the first one was in Poughkeepsie, New York, and it was a real, it was a mistake because we left the back of the mall on. So it was still a mall, but it was also a hybrid. So it was a strip center. So the strip center tenants faced out to the parking lot, but we still had the mall. And it was basically listed, there's a website called Dead Malls, and it was one of the premier dead malls in the country because nobody went and shopped at the rest of it since we, you know, just basically cut off all the traffic into the interior mall. So the next ones we did, we completely emptied them out and built around the periphery. And then one of them we sold to Costco, and the other large, we just, you know, knocked everything down and gave them a pad to build. And then the other one we sold to a Walmart. So that's, we learned our, you learn lessons. And, but redoing malls is difficult because what most people don't understand is a lot of times the anchor tenants own their spaces, and there's things called reciprocal easement agreements that you have to live up to a lot of different clauses that, you know, you don't even have a lease with it, but there's a shared responsibility in a lot of stuff. We're really bullish on grocery anchored shopping centers. We're really bullish on necessity retail. I would never do an interior mall again, just because the expenses outweigh what the tenants can pay. The tenants, normally you bill back what's called common area maintenance. And so the interior expenses, you're billing back interior landscaping, you're billing back air conditioning, heating, in addition to all the insurance and snow plowing and what have you. And those expenses end up being around $25 a foot, just, you know, as something just sitting there. And most of these smaller tenants, unless they have a high margin, they can't do that type of volume to pay that. And so that as soon as those expenses go up, your rent goes down.
And you're not doing 6 foot wide hallways in a shopping center. These are like 40, 50 foot wide hallways.
Right.
And so those are, that's a massive amount of square footage that is earning zero revenue per square foot.
100%. Yeah. 100%. So that's why we prefer, and I've always preferred, what you can either call them open centers or strip centers, but it's where, you know, somebody can drive up to the front of the store, they can park there and, you know, they can get in and out, and it's a convenience type of a thing.
Absolutely. So where do you see, you talked a little bit about repurposing malls, and I mean, one of the ways that I have seen that is, for example, some of the REITs have been buying up shopping malls and taking a corner of the parking lot and putting a high-rise tower on it, making it more residential, letting the mall continue as it is, but using some of the underutilized parking for that mall to build additional value. Is that a viable strategy in your opinion? Is that, or are you better off just putting a small restaurant with a drive-through in that corner?
It's certainly a viable strategy. It really depends. I mean, if you're a REIT, you've got a lot, you know, better access to capital at lower capital costs. So because, you know, that type of undertaking is a really long undertaking, because not only do you have to get all the approvals from the city, and a lot of cities, like we were looking at a mall a few years back and we were going to take a large portion of it and do senior housing. And the city said, absolutely not. We don't want rental housing. We don't want senior housing. We want it retail. Because in certain states that depend on retail taxes, like Illinois, the municipality gets 1-2% of the sales taxes back to them. So they have really an incentive not to allow residential, because they consider residential creating a lot of needs for, you know, services, versus if you've got retail, it creates a lot of income for them with very little, you know, service needs. That's the hard part, is doing that. You see most malls are almost fully developed out with the outparcel type of, like, you know, restaurants and all the rest of that stuff. And that's another thing is that the biggest shift from COVID is that even if they were quick service restaurants, like let's say it was a Panera or a Five Guys or a Shake Shack, they were before no drive-through whatsoever. Now, almost every one of them is demanding a drive-through because they realized, and even McDonald's, I think, is over the past 10 years, even before COVID, they were like 60% of all their revenue was through drive-through. And then Chick-fil-A is just insane. I think they're like up around 70 to 80% of their revenue. And then the all-time, it's a hot dog chain that's based out of California. I forget what it's called, but Wiener something. Anyway, they're getting like 95% of all their revenues through drive-through. So,
Fascinating. One of the things that we've seen over the last couple of years is a trend towards resurgence in the downtown core, revitalization of the downtown core in many cities. And yet many of those communities are lacking for amenities in the core. They lack grocery stores. They lack a lot of the amenities that the suburbs have become very accustomed to. Do you see a resurgence in the downtown core in retail? Is it something that you even are interested in playing in? What's your perspective?
I've always thought the downtown core retail was way overvalued. So there was certain markets like, you know, the near north side of Chicago, certain, you know, sections of Austin, or, you know, any of these different places, the cap rates on those were always insane. And they were always billed as flagship stores. And so that's not the, you know, type of thing we play in. We'll play in something where, you know, you can get a higher cap rate. We'll actually, on triple net deals, you know, buy something with a little less term on it. Like most people want 10 to 15 years. But since we, you know, are familiar with redevelopment and releasing, we'll take, you know, cap rate risk and a lower term risk. So the downtown core, and even in the city, it's been a rough go. I've seen stuff that it's doing really well in the southern states. But the northern states during COVID just basically killed their downtowns. And I'm not sure if it's coming back. And then the other issue is, unless there's a really good residential presence down there, because retail follows rooftops. And so unless there's a really good residential presence around it, you know, downtown and city retail just isn't doing well because of the, again, we go back to the work from home, you know, the three letter word, WFH, you know, and so that's really affecting, you know, not only the office buildings, but also, you know, the downtowns. And so it makes it even harder to get a grocery store or somebody that's going to, you know. And then I'm just going to point out, I was in at a conference in New York in February, and I have never seen New York like this. It had about 25% vacancy in retail. And there's all these restaurants that they're never used to anywhere in Manhattan. I never saw any vacancy, or like maybe one or two. And this is like on every block, there's all these closed restaurants. And I would hope they're coming back, but, you know, with the, and I'm, you know, not going to get political, but just the way Chicago, LA, and New York, and some of these other cities are operating, those retailers are not coming back unless people can feel safe. And, you know, permanently, they've had a permanent exodus of a lot of people. I could tell you, you know, also hanging out down in Florida, you know, the East Coast of Florida used to be, you know, New York and New Jersey, Florida. And, you know, now it's like you go to Tampa and everything else, and there's just a gigantic, you know, it's just like New York completely up and moved down there. So the entire state, as well as you're seeing a lot of New Yorkers and Californians in Texas, too. So the COVID policies really forced a lot of migrations to a lot of different places and away from larger cities like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. Well, Michael, if folks want to connect, if they want to learn more, what's the best way?
They can contact me through our website. It's libertyfund.io. Just go with the contact information. If they're looking to learn more about blockchain real estate, they can go to our other website, which is the new company that we're putting together. It's going to be a platform where you can actually invest and trade in crowdfund shareable, tradable, syndicated securities. And that is investonmain.com. So if you want the blockchain real estate report, we really are proud of that. It explains in detail how to get started, but that's investonmain.com, and hit the report button. You can get the report.
Fantastic. Well, Michael, always awesome to catch up. And for the listeners at home, definitely connect with Michael. Get a copy of his blockchain report at investonmain.com. And definitely visit his website at libertyfund.io. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.